Jerry, you're a writer, and now you're a publisher. You have an illustrator, Glenn Wolf, and your wife, Gail Dennis, working with you, starting up a brand new press, Big Maple Press. Can you tell us about that?
This has been a really interesting and fun project that we've had in mind for many years. Gail is a graphic designer and has worked in the book arts for many years. And, of course, Glenn and I are passionate about making books in any way we can. And so this was always just sort of something we wanted to add to our experience and try out. And we've kind of wanted to try everything. So we've delved into e-books and audiobooks and books published by major publishers and books published by very small presses. And this is just sort of the last thing that we hadn't tried yet. So our idea was to start the small press, to bring out some of our earlier works that are out of print and bring them out in new updated editions the way we always wanted them to be, and to bring out one or two new books a year as well.
So you're doing not just your books, but you're doing books by other authors and artists as well?
We have no intention or no plans of doing that yet. It's possible down the road, but we have enough of our own work to get out that's plenty for now.
Well, no argument there. You're very prolific. Now, is any of this starting your own press, is any of this got anything to do with a dissatisfaction with traditional publishing, or a lot of authors have been up in arms lately about Amazon? Is any of that part of your decision making?
Yes, that was definitely part of it. I was one of 600 authors who signed a letter that was published as a full-page ad in the New York Times, protesting Amazon's bullying tactics. And so, you know, that was part of it. It feels kind of good, you know, when Amazon is trying to get a corner on the world's market of books, it feels kind of good to create something that they can't get their hands on. So that was why we decided to make Big Maple Press books available only through independent bookstores. And they even have a logo on the cover that says Indie Bookstore Edition. So that was part of it. It was a little bit of a protest, more for the fun of it, though, and more also to give something to these independent bookstores, which have been so instrumental in our careers. They've been great supporters of ours from the beginning and have stood by us, so we're standing by them.
I wonder if that's not part of the very beginning of a movement. You're not the first author I've talked to that is working exclusively with independent booksellers. So I think that's interesting.
I've been picking up on it as well since we announced that we were doing this. We've heard from a number of authors who are doing other things as well. Interesting.
And have you gotten some feedback from booksellers as well?
Well, yeah, they've been incredibly supportive and very excited about this. So they're actually spreading the word among the other bookstores for us. So we're lucky to have them on our side, as always. It's great.
Can you give us some background on your illustrator, Glenn Wolf? He's got some wonderful illustrations in some of the books you've already been putting out.
Yes, Glenn's very, very talented. He and I, and Gail and I, went to high school together in Traverse City, and
long-standing relationship then.
Really, and but we didn't know each other, and it wasn't until the mid 1980s when Glenn was living in New York and was a regular illustrator for the New York Times that we started to get in touch with each other. And about that time, I think it was about 1987 or 86, he moved back to Traverse City with his family and decided he wanted to raise his kids here. And we got together and we sat down for lunch, our first meeting, and sketched out the idea for the first book that we did together. It's Raining Frogs and Fishes, which is about natural wonders of the sky. And we've been working together ever since. He's illustrated 8 of my books.
And Gail, your wife, you mentioned a little bit earlier, she's a graphic designer, and she's the one who's putting all of these books together?
She is. She's the creative director. She designs the books, does the layout and production, works with the printers, keeps us on schedule, and does all of that.
Yeah, we always need one of those.
So, you're a writer. You know all about that. We're experts at finding ways to procrastinate.
That, oh, sure. Yeah. We've got that down pat. So are you just reissuing some of your books, or have you come up with some that are brand new?
We have reissued two, and our first one, It's Raining Frogs and Fishes, and its companion volume, which is about wonders of water, called The Bird and the Waterfall. And the third is a new one, and that'll be out this summer. And it's as yet untitled, but it's about wonders of the animal kingdom.
And The Bird and the Waterfall, now there's an interesting story behind that title, I understand. Wasn't it originally with HarperCollins, or can you tell that?
Yes, it was originally published by HarperCollins. Both of them were It's Raining Frogs and Fishes as well. And the title was challenging for a book about the wonders of water. We didn't want to call it simply The Wonders of Water. And because I think we covered so much ground, we decided to name it for one of the chapters, which is called The Bird and Waterfall, which is the story of the water ouzel, or the American dipper, which is a bird of the western states that will nest right behind waterfalls often and spends its whole life in and around very fast mountain rivers. And it's a bird that's fascinated me most of my life. I first encountered it when I was about 17 years old, when I was in the mountain states for the first time, and I watched this incredible, very plain-looking bird. It looks about the size, it's about the size of a robin, and it's very gray color, very undistinctive, and until you watch its behavior. And I watched this bird hopping along rocks along the river and then suddenly dive into the fast part of the river and swim as if it were flying, flapping its wings, swimming beneath the surface of really fast water, picking aquatic insects out from among the rocks. So I began researching it and have been interested in it ever since.
Fascinating. Any plans to reissue the Living Great Lakes in the greater Kalamazoo community? We're really getting to know that book because it's the Reading Together book. And so we're all delving into that one. But I'm wondering, are you planning to reissue that in your own press or not?
Well, perhaps someday if it goes out of print. It just was recently released in its 17th printing from St.
Wow.
Martin's Press. And they're very happy with it and want to keep it in print. The way the publishing industry works is an author or artist needs to secure the rights to a book before they can do something new with it. So these two books from HarperCollins had nice long runs with HarperCollins and were translated into other languages and enjoyed a lot of success. But a few years ago, HarperCollins decided to let them go out of print. So once they did, then we just went through the legal channels necessary to have the rights returned to us so that we could do anything we want with it. If that ever happens with the Living Great Lakes, I'll surely do it. We'll definitely want to keep it in print. But right now it's in good hands, and they're doing a great job of getting it out there to bookstores.
Now, in a nutshell, could you summarize, I would say, for the three people in Greater Kalamazoo that haven't read it yet, can you summarize what that book is about?
Well, it's the story of the Great Lakes told from the decks of boats, especially and predominantly from the deck of a two-masted schooner named the Malabar that I was a crew member on, and we sailed it from Traverse City in northern Lake Michigan through the Great Lakes to the Hudson River, down to Long Island Sound and up the East Coast to Bar Harbor, Maine, to deliver it to a new owner. And that journey gave me the literal platform from which to tell the story of the lakes, plus the adventure story of taking this very eventful journey with four very colorful other people and learning so much about the region as we went, and about sailing, because I was new to it. And it's just an opportunity to tell all these stories while traveling through the lakes.
And it is a wonderful read. I enjoyed it very much. Now, Jerry, you have a wide range. You write fiction, nonfiction, poetry even. Fair to say you're best known for nonfiction, and are you happy with that?
I am. I very much enjoy writing nonfiction, especially the essay form. And it's not what I was trained in. I I studied fiction and poetry in college and always sort of assumed that's what I would write. But shortly after college, I was given the opportunity to write a short essay about rivers for a magazine. And I enjoyed it so much that it just set me off on my life's course, which is really about writing about the things I'm interested in and the experiences I have while exploring them.
Writing and publishing have both very much changed. Like me, you began writing on typewriters with bottles of Whiteout.
yeah.
Do you still?
And no spell check, yes, I know.
I don't know if that's always a good thing or a bad thing. Spell check sometimes irritates me more than not. How do you write today? Are you now converted to computer keyboards or are you still on the typewriter?
Well, I still write most of my first drafts in longhand, and that's partly, I think, because I got in the habit of it because I spent so much time writing in the field, and that seems the most natural for me. Occasionally, I'll sit down to the keyboard and start writing a first draft on the keyboard, which is great when it happens because it's so fast, but more often than not, I need that direct connection with the pen and the paper, and once I get that down, then I go to the computer and I type it in, create a file, type it in, and do the editing. And that's of course where the big advantage is. We can edit and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite so much easier than we used to, and when we had to type a whole new draft every time.
Oh yeah, I don't miss the Whiteout.
No. I had an electric typewriter was my second one. My first book I typed on a manual typewriter. My second one on an electric. A giant electric typewriter that vibrated so much that it gradually would bounce its way across my desk, and I'd have to pick it up and weigh about 50 pounds and move it back, and then it would continue to bounce its way along.
Sometimes I miss that little ding at the end, though. That was very satisfying.
That too, yeah.
So, Jerry, how were you introduced to nature? I mean, it's all in your writing, and it seems to be who you are. How were you introduced? And I ask that because today's younger generations are so stuck to screens and televisions and computers and games that we're losing that connection to nature. And how do we change that, and should we?
Well, that's such an interesting question. You know, personally, I came to it through my parents. We lived on a lake in northern Michigan, and my parents loved the outdoors, and my father loved hunting and fishing. My mother loved birds and woods, and my earliest memories are of walking in the woods and walking and hunting mushrooms and looking at birds and walking the shore of Lake Michigan and being out on the boat and on our lake and on the big lakes and on the area rivers. So that's, you know, that's the traditional way, I think, of kids getting turned on to it. And you're right, we're losing that. I don't know how serious a problem it is. I see so many kids who weren't necessarily introduced to it, but who are coming to it on their own eventually. My own sons are a really good example. My oldest son is the first generation of kids to grow up with a computer and to play video games and to get, you know, in that world. I mean, he was the one who first introduced me to the Internet. I had never even heard of it until he showed me, and he was 12 years old. And I worried that, you know, they weren't going to have an appreciation for the natural world and would spend their lives, you know, in a dark room playing with a computer. And it couldn't be more untrue. Once they reached the age where they made their own decisions, being outdoors became a big part of their lives and continues to be now in their adulthood. So I don't worry a whole lot about it, but I do like to see kids given the opportunity, and I'm always encouraged when I see parents and friends taking kids out and organizations doing it. And there are many of them around our region that have become involved, you know, like the Inland Seas Association in Suttons Bay, Michigan. They have a school ship, and they have now taken something like 80,000 school children out on Lake Michigan to teach them about the ecology of the lakes and freshwater sciences, and that has had a big impact. I've met a few of the kids who who experienced that years ago, who are now making a career out of research on the Great Lakes and other natural subjects. So they need to be introduced, of course, and we have to do what we can to help in that way.
I would think you can't love nature and not be an environmentalist, to at least to some degree. And you deal with some of that in the Reading Together book, The Living Great Lakes. What are your views on how we are treating our Mother Nature, and in Michigan specifically, the waterways?
Well, you know, it's an ugly history, and we've done a lot of things wrong. My default, I think, is to look for optimistic things and signs for hope, because, you know, as a child of the 60s, and I'm remembering so vividly how bad it was in those days, how polluted the waterways were in the air, I was, you know, very concerned, and I became active in trying to change that. And so I'm always alert for signs that it is changing, and I'm seeing that, and I think we all can see that now. I mean, many of our waterways are cleaner. The air is cleaner in most places. It's not universally true, of course. I mean, there are places on the Great Lakes that have very serious problems, and much work still needs to be done. But to see the difference made politically, for instance, it used to be that the environmental movement was a partisan issue, and it's no longer true. Every politician recognizes that their constituents care, and also that a clean environment is good for the economy, and we're seeing evidence of that constantly now. So Great Lakes cities, it really began with Chicago, but now Toronto and Milwaukee and Detroit, and many, many smaller cities as well are taking charge and are learning that by cleaning up their waterways and freshening up their waterfronts, they are benefiting in countless ways. Quality of life and the economy are both on the upswing. So that's a definite sign for optimism.
Good to hear. Now, if you had to give one advice, one urging to the residents of Michigan, because with the Great Lakes, we have something here that no other state really has, what is the most important thing that we residents of this state can do for the Great Lakes?
I think speak up, attend meetings, write to your representatives. Don't let our guard down, because, you know, as optimistic as I tend to be by nature, I'm also a realist, and I know that there are people who will do what is most profitable and easiest, and that's often at the expense of our water and air and land. There are things going on that we should all be involved in, I think, and should all step up and speak out against, like the oil pipes under the Great Lakes and the spill, the potential for spills like you suffered so terribly on the Kalamazoo River a few years ago.
Yeah.
That could happen in the Great Lakes as well. There's an oil line under the Straits of Mackinac that's 60 years old, that's pumping millions of gallons of crude oil a day beneath the lake and across Michigan and then across the St. Clair River to Sarnia, and it's incredibly vulnerable to rupture. And if it ruptures, it's going to be a disaster unlike any we've ever seen in the Great Lakes. And nothing will change until we put pressure on the governor and our representatives to step in and demand that these pipes be inspected and upgraded. So, you know, those kinds of things. I really do believe that just making sure that our lawmakers know we care is more important probably than anything.
And do you think that if we did have an oil spill like that, say, near Mackinac, would we be able to recover the waterways?
It would take decades. I'm convinced. The computer models are terrifying. It shows this oil, not just an oil slick on the surface, spreading very rapidly in both directions into Lake Michigan and Lake Huron, but along the bottom. And I read, while I was working on the Living Great Lakes, I did research and talked to some experts about how petroleum products in general behave in freshwater as opposed to salt. And it's very different than an oil spill in the ocean. The oil does not clump together like it does in the ocean, which makes it, in salt water, it clumps together, which makes it easier to contain. In freshwater, it very rapidly disperses into droplets, and those droplets cover an immense amount of area in a really quick amount of time, and they create all kinds of havoc. So it would be a big problem for a long, long time. It would be the prominent news story of a decade, I think.
Well, hopefully people will hear that and take it seriously. So talk to us, Jerry, about your participation coming up here in March for the Reading Together. You're going to be visiting Kalamazoo soon?
I am, yes. I'm looking forward to that very much. It's such a terrific honor to have a book selected to a Reading Together program. And so I'll be at... Now I can't remember even where I'll be.
That's all right.
At the Kalamazoo Public Library on March 3rd. They have another program the next day in the afternoon to talk about writing, the craft of writing, but I'm not sure where that'll be held yet.